How we open our Bibles. In some ways, this study is a conclusion of the series we've been involved in Matthew chapter 1 and 2. But it's not really a conclusion because next Sunday we're going on into a new series starting in Matthew chapter 3. But our passage for this morning is the Gospel of Matthew chapter 2, reading from verse 13 through to the end of the chapter. Matthew's Gospel, chapter 2, verse 13. Let's hear God's word together. When the wise men had gone, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. "Get up," he said, "take the child and his mother and escape to Egypt. Stay there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to kill him." So he got up, took the child and his mother during the night, and left for Egypt, where he stayed until the death of Herod. And so was fulfilled what the Lord had said through the prophet, "Out of Egypt I called my son." When Herod realized that he had been outwitted by the Magi, he was furious, and he gave orders to kill all the boys in Bethlehem and its vicinity who were 2 years old and under, in accordance with the time he had learned from the Magi. Then what was said through the prophet Jeremiah was fulfilled. "A voice is heard in Ramah, weeping and great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children and refusing to be comforted, because they are no more." After Herod died, an angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt and said, "Get up, take the child and his mother and go to the land of Israel, for those who were trying to take the child's life are dead." So he got up, took the child and his mother, and went to the land of Israel. But when he heard that Archelaus was reigning in Judea in place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. Having been warned in a dream, he withdrew to the district of Galilee, and he went and lived in a town called Nazareth. So was fulfilled what was said through the prophets, "He will be called a Nazarene." Someone pointed out on the radio the other day that January the 1st, 1996, will be the first New Year's Day for a very long time indeed, when there hasn't been a fairly substantial war going on somewhere in the world. If you think about it, that observation is quite true. In Bosnia, the NATO troops are separating the hostile factions. In Northern Ireland, the ceasefire still holds. In the Middle East, Palestinian and Israeli are discussing political settlement. In fact, in just about every trouble spot that has featured in the news over the last couple of years, peace, just at the moment, prevails. Is that significant, do you think? I suspect there will be some who will be tempted to read significance into it. Those who've embraced the optimistic prognostications of New Age, perhaps, may well see it as an early sign of the Aquarian harmony, which they anticipate will increasingly characterize our world as more and more people get in tune with cosmic consciousness. And it wouldn't surprise me if some Christians didn't share a rather similar sense of millennial utopianism as 1996 dawns. For, you know, there was a very popular speculation in the early centuries of our era among the Christians that the entire history of the world would span 7,000 years. Not knowing anything about dinosaurs and fossils, 7,000 years seemed a perfectly reasonable duration for the Earth. 1,000 years for every day of those 7 days of creation. Doesn't the Bible say that one day with the Lord is as 1,000 years? And the final 1,000 years, of course, the one corresponding to God's Sabbath rest on the seventh day, they reckon that would be the expected millennium, when Christ would reign on earth. Now, of course, if you accept that view of things, as many early Christians did, and if you accept Archbishop Usher's famous chronology based on the patriarchal genealogies in the book of Genesis. Then, of course, you will hold that the world was created at 9 a.m. on October the 26th in the year 4004 B.C. The 6,000th anniversary of which date, of course, will fall next autumn. So put those two pieces of speculation and calculation together, and who knows, but by this time next year, the swords will all have been beaten into plowshares and the spears into pruning hooks. Maybe by next year we shall be having our Christmas dinner in New Jerusalem. And maybe this uncharacteristic outbreak of peace in the world is just a little foretaste, a hint of that imminent global shalom. Well, maybe. And then again, maybe not. You'll have to forgive me if I prick the bubble of anticipation that maybe I've created in you and prove rather disappointingly skeptical about it all. I fear the eschatology of those early Christians and Bishop Usher's arithmetic are probably equally unreliable. And as for the age of Aquarius, well, maybe those New Age astrologers should try their optimistic forecasts for 1996 on the family of Philip Lawrence, that headmaster who was stabbed to death outside his school a couple of weeks ago. Or maybe they should try it on the family of that young French woman found murdered by the roadside in Worcester this past week. Or maybe they would find a ready audience amongst those 10 people recovering in hospital today after a random knife attack at a Birmingham supermarket. Now, when you take your rose-tinted spectacles off, it is quite clear that the statistics of violence in our world are not on the decline at all. If anything, they're even more gruesome. If the guns of war have fallen silent on the international scene, you can be sure it is only a temporary remission. They will be firing again soon. You wait and see. And no magic date in the calendar of 1996 is going to miraculously transform that sad outlook. Unless, of course, what was it those Bethlehem angels sang? Peace on earth, goodwill toward men. Well, were they mistaken then, do you think? Had they got their calculations wrong too? I guess Joseph and Mary could have been forgiven in thinking so, the way things turned out. After all, if any date in the calendar ought to have signalled an improvement in world affairs, it was that first Christmas day. Wasn't this baby the promised Messiah, the one whose coming to the world inaugurated the kingdom of God? And yet you see, in those early days after his birth, things for Joseph and Mary got decidedly worse, not better at all. Get up, take the child and his mother, and escape to Egypt. Stay there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to kill him. When Herod realized he had been outwitted by the Magi, he was furious, and he gave orders to kill all the boys in Bethlehem and its vicinity who were 2 years old and under. Historians tell us that this kind of brutality was in every way typical of King Herod the Great. The man was obsessed with suspicion and anxiety about imagined rivals to his throne who were secretly conspiring to overthrow him. No sooner had he got to the throne than he slaughtered the Jewish Sanhedrin because they dared to suggest his claim to the crown was illegitimate. Later he assassinated 300 of his own court officials out of a similar fear of palace coup. And as if all that wasn't enough, he went on to murder his wife, his mother-in-law, his brother-in-law, his uncle, and three of his own sons in similar fits of paranoia. So the massacre of probably at most 20 or 30 small children within the peasant community that lived in the village of Bethlehem, that would have been all in a day's work for a homicidal maniac like Herod. It's little wonder the incident isn't recorded outside of Matthew's gospel. Comparatively speaking, it was a minor incident in Herod's reign. But for Joseph and Mary, it must have been a nightmare. And think of the guilt, the strange guilt they must have felt as they heard about that butchery on their way down to Egypt. At the very least, they must have seen it as a decidedly odd way for divine providence to greet the birth of the Christ child. He had been in the world only a few months, and already this heralded Prince of Peace was causing bloodshed and misery. So I ask again, were those angels misinformed? With all that caroling about peace on earth, goodwill toward men, was it all a disastrous mistake? At the very least, you have to say again it was a savage irony. For I guess some of those little boys who perished in Bethlehem must have belonged to the families of those very shepherds who had gone to the manger at the direction of those Christmas angels. I wonder what those shepherds were saying now. Did they not have a right to feel bitterly let down? If you can't trust an angel of the Lord, who can you trust? But then if you think about it, I guess the first readers of Matthew's gospel might well have felt some sympathy with those disillusioned shepherds in their experience of blighted hope. Didn't they have good grounds for feeling disillusioned too? They lived, of course, in the second half of the first century. They were early Christians. If that first Christmas day should have been the prelude of a better world, how much more should the first Easter day have heralded such an improvement in the state of affairs? Christ had not only been born, he had risen from the dead. He'd ascended to glory. He had poured out his spirit upon his followers in wind and fire. If anything was going to be the harbinger of the millennium, surely this, at last, had to be it. But no, what did those early Christians find? Instead of the prosperity and blessing of the age to come, they found only the cruelty of the sword. The barbarity of Herod's massacre of the innocents pales into insignificance beside the barbarity of Nero's persecution of the early church. Like Joseph and Mary before them, they must have wondered what kind of Messiah this Jesus was turning out to be. Had the prophets got it wrong when they called him the Prince of Peace? It would have been an understandable question. Indeed, it's a question, of course, that has echoed down now through 2,000 years of history, as generation after generation of Christians have looked forward to the peace of Christ's kingly rule, but found instead in their present experience the harshness and bitterness, the violence even, of that flight into Egypt. Have the prophets got it wrong? I suspect that's the very question that motivates Matthew to write his gospel, you know. For one thing you will discover as you read Matthew's gospel is that he is particularly keen to demonstrate that contrary to whatever doubts some might have been expressing on the point, in fact, everything about Jesus, from the day of his conception right through to the day of his resurrection, everything about Jesus fitted precisely with the Old Testament prophetic expectation concerning him. Even those tough and painful bits that no one perhaps had explained before the event, like the grief-stricken weeping of those mothers in Bethlehem. Most of the Jews, you see, in Jesus' day, and perhaps some of those early Christians too in Matthew's church, had constructed their picture of what the Messiah and his kingdom would be like from a very small handful of Old Testament texts that had been greatly embroidered by rabbinic commentary and elaborated by lurid apocalyptic speculations. Without exception, it was a triumphalist picture of victory and blessing they had in their mind. Tribulation was something the Messiah came to abolish, not to make worse. But Matthew, you see, in common with the apostolic testimony of the New Testament generally, sees Jesus' fulfillment of Old Testament prophecy against a much broader backcloth than that. He wants us to see that the Messiah comes, first of all, to be the obedient Son of God, which Old Testament Israel should have been, but never was. He has not just come to fulfill a handful of glib proof texts. This Messiah must experience Israel's troubled history in his own troubled life. He must identify her with her in her trials, in her sufferings. At the end, he must even identify with her in the judgment of God upon her sins. Take, for example, Matthew's fascinating interpretation of the flight of Jesus and his family from Herod's murderous rage in verse 15. Do you see what his comment is about this incident? "So was fulfilled what the Lord had said through the prophet, 'Out of Egypt I called my son.'" Now that text is from Hosea chapter 11 in the Old Testament. It refers to the way the infant nation of Israel spent its earliest years enslaved in Egypt. It is not, in the strictest sense of the word, a messianic prophecy. There's no evidence that Hosea had in mind a savior to come when he penned those words. The son spoken of in that text quite clearly is a metaphor for the nation of Israel. "Out of Egypt I called my son, Israel." But Matthew, you see, interestingly, sees this text being fulfilled in a new way in Jesus. He is the infant Son of God. And he must recapitulate that exodus from Egypt in his own personal history. Just as we shall see next week, he would a little later recapitulate Israel's testing in the wilderness, if not for 40 years, then at least for 40 days. He must experience, you see, the suffering of his people in order, like Moses, to deliver them from those sufferings. And it's in that context that Matthew can say, "So was fulfilled what was said through the prophet, 'Out of Egypt I called my son.'" It's in that same context of broad Old Testament fulfillment that Matthew makes sense of Herod's brutal slaughter too. Notice his comment on this in verse 17 and 18. "Thus what was said through the prophet Jeremiah was fulfilled," he says. "A voice is heard in Ramah, weeping and great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children and refusing to be comforted because they are no more." Now, this is a text from Jeremiah chapter 31 in the Old Testament, and it spoke originally of the grief of the mothers of Judah after the Babylonian conquest because their sons had been taken into exile and they didn't know if they would ever see them again. Once again, this is not a messianic prophecy in the sense that it was firmly anchored in the events of Jeremiah's own day. And yet, once again, Matthew sees an echo from that past experience of God's people reverberating here in the story of Jesus 5 centuries later. "For now the great-great-granddaughters of Rachel are once again in mourning because of the loss of their children." What has happened? The tyranny and the godlessness of wicked kings have brought this upon the innocent. Just as it happened in the time of the exile. Yet just as in the time of the exile, the situation is not a totally hopeless one. For though the exile in Babylon was a disaster, Israel would learn, just as in the case of that earlier bondage in Egypt, that in a strange way the exile in Babylon would be an incubator of divine blessing. If you read the full section in Jeremiah 31, from which Matthew's text in verse 18 is drawn, you'll discover that's precisely the prophet Jeremiah's point. Those who went into exile amidst many tearful goodbyes represented the nation's future hope. For, says Jeremiah, they will return one day from that land of exile. And Israel will find in that new exodus the dawn also of a new era of hope. Interestingly, Matthew draws attention again to this Old Testament kind of resonance when he mentions in verses 21 and 21 the land of Israel. Do you notice twice he uses that phrase? Go to the land of Israel. They went to the land of Israel. Though you might not pick it up, it's a rather archaic form of expression there. You certainly find the land of Israel as a phrase nowhere else in Matthew's gospel. For of course, there was no land of Israel, strictly speaking, in Jesus' day anymore. The territory that had once been known by that name had been fragmented and relabeled by the Roman Empire. It was now called Judea or Perea or Galilee. But Matthew deliberately, I think, uses that archaic geographical term here in order to reinforce that resonance with Old Testament history that he's trying to allude to. Jesus is the new Moses, leading his people out of Egyptian bondage to the land of Israel. He is the new king, returning from exile to the land of Israel to restore hope to those bereaved mothers of Judah. Where is he going to make his base? In Jerusalem, like David before him? No. Here too, you see, Matthew is convinced divine providence is ensuring that Jesus fulfills the prophetic expectation. Look at verses 22 and 23. When Joseph heard that Archelaus was reigning in Judea in place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. Having been warned in a dream, he withdrew to the district of Galilee. And he went and lived in a town called Nazareth. So was fulfilled what was said through the prophets. He will be called a Nazarene. Now, once again, you look in vain in the Old Testament for an unambiguous messianic prophecy that says he will be called a Nazarene. In fact, you look in vain in the New Testament to find any text that says he will be called a Nazarene. Matthew is not here quoting a specific Old Testament passage at all. That's why I suspect he uses the plural, prophets, rather than specifying the particular prophet he has in mind. What he's explaining to us here is the general tenor of Old Testament prophetic expectation about the Messiah. He will be called a Nazarene. Some commentators think he's using the word Nazarene there as a pun. A pun, perhaps, on the Nazirite vow, which Samson took, or rather more likely, a pun on the Hebrew word Nazar, which means a branch, which is used messianically by some of the Old Testament prophets. But if such a pun is intended by Matthew, I think one has to say it's a rather poor pun, and one that would have only been intelligible to a fraction of his readers who knew Hebrew. A more likely suggestion is that Nazareth, as far as a first century Palestinian gazetteer was concerned, Nazareth was the epitome of obscurity. You could not find a more obscure place than Nazareth. It's the equivalent of some remote rural village in the Pennine moorlands of Lancashire. If people had heard of Nazareth at all, it was only to mock it as a kind of geographical Cinderella, a non-entity of a town, where only non-entities would choose to live. Maybe that would be a better sort of reading of Matthew's intention in verse 23. He went and lived in a town called Nazareth. So was fulfilled what was said through the prophets. He will be called a nobody. Nobodies were the only people who lived in Nazareth. Safe enough for the infant king to grow up there. No one in their right mind expected a messiah to come from that town. It would be like looking for a future British Prime Minister in Form 5F at Hackney Comprehensive. But then that's the point, isn't it? That's just what the Old Testament prophets had predicted about him. He would not be recognized. He would emerge from anonymity and obscurity. What was it Isaiah said about him? He will grow up before the Lord like a tender shoot, a root in a dry ground. In other words, an unexpected sign of hope and fertility in what seemed to be a completely barren and useless piece of ground. He had no beauty, Isaiah goes on, no majesty to attract people to him. Nothing that is in his appearance that betrayed his divine pedigree. On the contrary, he was despised and rejected by men, says Isaiah. A man of sorrows and familiar with suffering. Like one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised. We esteemed him not. Where's he from? Those snooty churchmen in Jerusalem would ask with a sneer. Nazareth? Nazareth? Can any good thing come out of Nazareth? But Nazareth it must be, because he had not come to patronize the rich and the mighty. He had come to save the poor in spirit, the lowly in heart. Humble folk, like his own earthly parents, Joseph and Mary. Yes, if I had been in their shoes, I think I would have been feeling it decidedly odd that a child of supernatural birth, heralded by angels, worshipped by magi from the Orient, should have had to flee the violence of some petty tyrant like Herod. I would think it incongruous that our family, the family of the Messiah, must hide away like political refugees in Egypt and make their home in that despised cultural backwater of Nazareth. But only in this way, you see, could he be the Saviour God had promised in the prophets, sharing our sufferings, carrying our sorrows, and eventually pierced for our transgressions and crushed for our iniquities. You remember what Isaiah said about him? The punishment that brought us peace was upon him. Oh yes, he was the Prince of Peace. The angels had not got it wrong. But in a violent and godless world, where the demonic malice of a Herod so often leaves behind it the carnage of the innocent, there is only one sure and permanent route to peace. It's called the Via Dolorosa, the pathway to the cross. And it's that pathway that not only Jesus himself would take, but his followers also, they must tread it. We who would call ourselves Christians in 1996, that is our path. See. It must not surprise us that the four horsemen of the apocalypse show no signs of returning to their stables at the moment. It must not surprise us that there are proud rulers in this world who, hot from hell, cry havoc, let slip the dogs of war. What is it the book of Revelation says? Woe to the earth. The devil has gone down to you. He is filled with fury. He knows his time is short. Now, it should not surprise us if in the wake of our Christmas caroling, we should find ourselves in Egypt or in Babylonian exile rather than New Jerusalem. It is the way of things. It has been the way of things for the people of the Messiah for 2,000 years. Though perhaps now, like those grieving mothers of Jerusalem, we can't see the sense in the divine purpose. Perhaps like Joseph and Mary, we look back over our shoulders at Bethlehem, the Christmas angels caroling, ringing hollow in our ears as we fight back the tears and grit our teeth and make for Egypt. One day, we shall look back again on the whole history of redemption, with all its strange and unexpected twists and turns in the plot. And then we shall see, as Matthew, with the inspired eye of a Bible writer, can see it so clearly, then we shall see, thus was fulfilled what was spoken by the prophets. We shall share his glory. But the price now is a willingness to be a participant in his sufferings. That's the way our Jesus walks.